We have been in the midst of a study on Hope Rises. And one of the reasons I chose to do this at this time of year is I get more questions on this time of year about things that we're wrestling with. There's something about the holidays as they approach that makes life a little bit more of a struggle, a little bit more of a challenge. And so all of these lessons have been based on things that you have brought to me. And I did not intend to preach on the one that we're going to preach on this morning. But yet it came up in a couple of different places where a bunch of you were standing. And before I knew it, I kind of got the impression from those groups that maybe I needed to preach on it. And so here was my approach. We're going to talk about depression. You might want to go to kids' church. Kent's got a point, at least a little bit. And so here is how I approached it. I am more than comfortable taking a chunk of scripture and explaining it to you. You're going to find I have way more notes this morning than I usually have because I want to make sure I'm at least fairly precise in at least some of the language we use at the beginning of this sermon. But here's how I came to at least the first page or two of the sermon. I talked with not only my doctor, but I talked with some of the doctors that are here in church and nurse practitioners, some who have worked in the mental health fields that go to church here. Then, after writing a sermon and having them look at all of it, I then sent it off to my therapist, who I have not had to see for a while, but who I keep in daily communication with, who also is licensed to prescribe drugs. He's some kind of doctor that goes with that, but I don't know what the right terms on that. After that, I then sent it to three different preachers I know who have all wrestled with depression. And I said, am I getting this right? And then last of all, I interviewed a few of you quietly, whether over the phone or in conversation or around a table. So this is not necessarily a first principles subject. But yet, I think it is something that if you haven't wrestled with it, you know somebody who does. And the numbers are alarming, who has wrestled with depression and how the church has maybe been faulty in how they have handled it at times. So let me just give you two stats. And I could give you a whole boatload of stats. But the ones that I found interesting are pre-COVID, over 17 million prescriptions were written for some sort of antidepressant. So pre-COVID, 17 million prescriptions. Post-COVID, that has almost tripled, which tells me either we're recognizing it better, we're treating it better, we're understanding it better, or what we've been through as a world the last 5 or 6 years has kind of rocked us a little bit. And I want to say two things up front. First, if you are wrestling with depression, and if it is more than you can handle, I think you need to talk with your doctor. I think you need to find a therapist. I think you need to work some things out. It may be physical. Now, it very easily could also be spiritual. And in that case, I think you need to talk with those men and women who are close to God who can help you along that line. I don't want to do what I fear the church has sometimes done, because the church has sometimes used this myth. They've said, good Christians don't feel bad. And if that is the case, then I am a lousy Christian, because I have felt bad. I have had days, and I've had weeks, and I've probably on occasion had months where I wrestled with depression on some level. And the way I dealt with it is not the way everybody else should deal with it. I did not deal with it through the medical side of things, because the doctor didn't think that was really where I needed help. I dealt with it through the mental health side of things. And so as I give you at least some of this information at the very beginning, I want us to wrestle with that myth that good Christians don't feel bad. Because I think everybody in this room has had moments when they've felt bad. Too many think the Christian life should be an instant joyride. And when we have this idea that the Christian life is an instant joyride, it causes a couple of things. I think first it causes Christians who are wrestling with depression to think they're even worse than they are. And the last thing someone who's wrestling with depression is to be told, you're worse than you think you are. The second thing is it has developed in us a mechanism that most of us probably use whether we know it or not. And that is, we just start to deny that there's even an issue. For example, in those moments in my life when I have wrestled with this subject, I would walk into this church building and I would need to put on my preacher's face, as well as my preacher's jacket and microphone and Bible. And I would be asked by 200 people, how are you? And guess what my answer was? Anybody want to guess? I'm fine. Now, you probably didn't want me to say, well, let me tell you a few things. Well, let's sit down, let's get a cup of coffee, and let's explore some of my trauma. You just heard me say I'm fine. And my guess is most of us do that out of reaction, but often we do that out of denial and out of I don't really want to face what might be haunting me. And I think we need to face those things. Depression is not always a choice. Few who are wrestling with it wake up in the morning and say, I think I want to feel bad today. They just do. So here's maybe a little bit of the medical side. Some of the causes for depression can be from everything from a biochemical problem all the way to circumstantial trouble, and I think to spiritual trouble. So let's first talk about the mechanics of our body. One of the things that helps take you out of the blues, so to speak, is what's called serotonin in your body. And again, this is my doctor friends who have been telling me this. When someone is wrestling with depression and their serotonin level is extremely low, doctors will often prescribe either a diet that helps you get serotonin back up, or they may prescribe an antidepressant that helps the neurotransmitters of the brain function a little better. Signs of this chemical brain problem are things like altered appetite, sleep disorders, moodiness, fatigue, cognitive dysfunction. That means you can't make up your mind. I think we all suffer from that at every restaurant. Withdrawal and a sense of hopelessness. So that is kind of from a doctor scientific point of view, saying if there is this physical issue within your body chemistry, it might be some of the root to what causes trouble. So I talked to my pharmacist friends. We have all kinds of medical people in this room. I don't know if you realize that. So some of them did a little research for me. And what's interesting is 75% of those who are struggling with serotonin levels and depression respond to an antidepressant. Doesn't mean it fixes the problem. It means they respond to it in a more positive way. And my guess is there are at least few, if not many, in this room who over the course of their life, or maybe for extended periods of time, have taken something to kind of level things off a little bit. I think it would be very foolish of me to say, if you're a Christian, just get over it. For instance, we have a few in this room that are diabetic. They are diabetic because their pancreas either doesn't produce the right stuff or it doesn't produce enough of it. And so they have to take anything from anything from a smaller thing to help with their diabetes all the way to insulin shots. And they do that because the pancreas is not working properly. We would never look at the diabetic and say, you know what, just get over it. I think we need to be careful sometimes when we talk to those who are wrestling with what we often call the blues, but is a lot more likely called depression, to just say, build this bridge and get over it. So I think you need to have some conversations. Conversations with your family, conversations with your healthcare providers, conversations with pharmacies, guys. Talk about some of those things. But I think there's also more to it than just chemical issues within our body. Some of our depression, and I'm going to be honest, my depression has often come from circumstantial problems. So it hasn't come because my body chemistry is off. It has come because life isn't always great, and life isn't always fair. And that sometimes there are hardships, and sometimes there are difficulties, and there are life changes, and there are prolonged periods of intense stress. And my guess is, if you were to diagnose yourself, you would say, at least some of those times when I have been down, it is because of those things, that life is hard. I mean, if you live in a family, if you work in a job, if you live in a neighborhood, you're going to have those moments where it's hard, and those moments where it's difficult, and those moments where you are discouraged and down. And some skills that maybe need to be found is maybe we need to learn to deal with it better. Now, that's not just throwing out some blanket saying, get over it. That's saying, how do we make situations better so we can handle it? It may mean I change my belief system. And I want us to talk about that more at the end. It may mean that I need to change my job, or I need to make some lifestyle adjustments, or I need to change the way I'm handling stress, or I need to change the way I'm going to sleep at night, or I need to change, and there could be 100 other blanks. And those are all blanks that can only be filled in by you and by those people around you. So it might be circumstantial. If you just had a baby, odds are you're going to wrestle with depression on some level. And it can be from minor to major. If you have lost a parent or someone you love, the odds of you dealing with these difficult circumstances, they're going to happen. And I'm not saying getting a prescription is always the answer, but life is so circumstantial, and the things that happen in and around us and to us and sometimes by us, those are not always things that we can control. And so when those things happen, I think we need to take a good look around us. Okay, the third thing is I think sometimes depression can be a spiritual problem. And I want to explain that with David here in a few minutes. But I run into a lot of people who wrestle with what we've been talking about a little bit, oddly enough, about the last quarter in our preaching, of this idea that their life is so messed up God couldn't put up with them. And so they've got a misunderstanding of grace and of how God wants to save, and so they carry around this guilt that just is a burden that weighs them down. And that burden that weighs them down starts to go to the blues, to something worse. There are some that are wrestling with things like bitterness and anger and rage. And the Bible says, get rid of all of these things. But when we wrestle with those things, all of those things tend to aid in our mood being less than what we want it to be. Sometimes we suffer from cognitive dissonance. Again, another kind of more medical term than spiritual term. But that's when you believe and how you behave are completely different. And you wrestle with that. You think about those moments when you've been kind of rebelling against God and you knew better. You rebel against God, but then you go back to your room and you think about it, and that takes your mood, and it lowers it and it lowers it and it lowers it, and it puts you in a funk, to use some of the terms we use sometimes. So I think it can be physical, and I think it can be circumstantial, and I think it can be spiritual, but it hits us all at times and in different ways. So we have a story in the Bible. It's unfortunately one of the most famous stories in the Bible, and it's one of the stories that I like to tell the least. And part of it is because David is one of our heroes, and so we don't want to talk about those moments when David is not the hero in the story. But we all know the story of David and Bathsheba. And David should be at war, but he's not at war, and instead he's walking around on his roof. My guess is, as he's walking around on his roof, he's looking at his kingdom, at all the place where he lives, and look how good I am. And up pops a pretty lady. And before you know it, the lady that has popped up is now in his chamber, and before you know it, things go south from there. You know the rest of the story. Nathan will come and give that kind of haunting parable, and will say, you are the man in the midst of that. And if you read that story, after Nathan has confronted David with the story of what he has done to not only Bathsheba, but what he has done to Uriah, David goes into an instant depression. And the reason, partly, is he's mourning because that child that is going to be born is going to be not alive very long. And the second reason is I think he's going through this cognitive dissonance. That all of his life he has been the man after God's own heart, and then for this one moment where sin just kind of grabs a hold of him and rages in his life, he's doing the exact thing he knows not to do. And that probably, if not most definitely, sends him in a spiral. And he writes this psalm. I just want to use two verses out of it. He says in verse 6 from Psalm 51, "Yet you desired faithfulness even in the womb. You taught me wisdom in that secret place." Okay, so here's what you've taught me. Then go to verse 10. David says, "Create in me a pure heart and renew a steadfast spirit within me, O God." It's David looking at his situation and looking at his sin and dealing with the consequences of his sin and dealing with eventually the loss of a child, that in the midst of all of that, he's going to say, okay, here's how you created me from the womb, but here's what I need you to do now. I need you to create in me a pure heart, O God, and to renew a steadfast spirit. See, that's a powerful prayer. And I think if you are wrestling with, and again, we'll call it all kinds of things, if you're wrestling with the blues a little bit, I think that needs to be part of our prayer, is that God would create in us a pure heart. So let me give you a couple principles, and here's where I feel a little more comfortable. Some important principles. After you've digested the first page, let's talk about the second page. Down and out doesn't mean out of God's favor. Okay, let me say that again. If you are feeling down, it doesn't mean God doesn't love you. And here's what I mean by that. Some of the greatest Bible heroes had moments when they were down. Let me just give you some. You're going to talk about them more in your small group. There's this fellow named Job, and this fellow named Job has got everything, and then this fellow named Job goes from having everything to having nothing but a grumpy wife and some friends that are a little bit biblically illiterate. And he is going to be saying some pretty depressing lines. He's going to talk about wishing he was dead, and he's going to talk about woe is me, and he's going to talk about all of this stuff that has happened to him. And yet, I don't think any of us have ever doubted if Job was right with God, even in the midst of that. Or Moses. Moses is wrestling with stiff-necked Israelites, and he gets angry and he gets frustrated. And there had to be moments where he just walked back into his tent with his arms crossed saying, I'm sick and tired of this and I don't want to deal with it anymore. There had to be those moments. But yet God is still going to use him triumphantly. Or Peter, as Luke tells the story, is standing around the fire and he's warming himself around the fire, and three times he's asked, do you know the fella who's on trial up there? And twice he denies it, and the third time when he does it, he swears up and down, and the rooster crows, and Jesus, it's haunting what Luke says, Jesus turns and looks at him. And the text says, Peter from that point began to weep. He's preaching the first sermon when the church starts. He's standing up in front of everybody saying, here is Christ. You killed him, but God raised him from the grave. Certainly, he wasn't out of God's favor just because he was going through a difficult time. And David, who we've already talked about, was certainly no emotional stoic. Let me just read a couple of lines from the Psalms. Psalm 6 reads like this. I am worn out from my groaning. All night long I flood my bed with weeping and drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow weak with sorrows. They fail because of my foes. Or the opening of Psalm 13 that Lee referred to a few minutes ago. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Okay, if you have wrestled, you have said some of those phrases. You have wrestled with, how long am I going to have to go through this? How long am I going to have to deal with a difficult marriage, or to deal with a difficult child, or to deal with the loss of someone I love, or to deal with, and then fill in all of those blanks. And you've over and over through tears said, how long, God, am I going to have to put up with this? And I want you to know that even in the midst of those how long questions, do not think that you are out of God's favor. Because none of those characters are out of God's favor. And what's interesting is in all of those Psalms, when David starts off with those phrases, how long, Lord? How long am I going to have to put up with this? How long am I going to sit in this bed of tears? At the end of almost all of those is going to be a praise of how God is going to deliver. And whether God has delivered David or not, he knows it will happen because he has God's favor. And I want you to know that you have got God's favor. That even in the midst of your sadness and even in the midst of moments when life is not the way it should be, trust that God is on your side. But the second thing, down does not mean out of God's future. Okay, let me read you. Oh, she ruined it. I meant to tell Lindsay, don't show that picture. Okay, so I want to give you, nobody look at the screen. Oh, wait, that's not blocking it for you. Okay, let me read you. As a kid, oh, man, this is my favorite part of the sermon. It's really not. I loved Paul Harvey. When I was a little kid, my mom would listen to Paul Harvey in the car on the way of taking us to school. I've loved him ever since and would love them to play his stuff still. Here's a little insert from one of his rest of the story lines. Many years ago, a young Midwestern lawyer, that fellow, suffered from such deep depression that his friends thought it best to keep all knives and razors out of reach. He questioned his life's calling and the prudence of even attempting to follow it through. During this time, he wrote in his journal, "I am now the most miserable man living. Whether I shall ever be better, I cannot tell. I awfully forebode I shall not. But somehow from somewhere," now pretend that picture just flashed up, "but somehow from somewhere Abraham Lincoln received the encouragement he needed and the achievements of his life thoroughly vindicated his bouts with depression." Now, wouldn't that have been more fun if I'd have told Lindsay not to flash that picture up? I think most of us, if we were asked to name the best president that's ever lived, that would be the guy we would name. And yet, he wrestled with his emotional health. And we all have episodes of wrestling with those things, but we need to remember that hopelessness is a lie that comes from the other side. That even in the midst of those wrestling, even in the midst of the downtimes, even in the midst of trying to figure out how we're ever going to get through this season, I need you to believe that there is hope on the other side. That's why hope rises, is that there's this understanding that God is going to say, I've got your back on this, and we're going to get through it. And let's be honest, you may not get through it in this life. But I'll make you one promise. I can't promise that you'll get through it on this life, and I can't promise that you won't have sad days, and I can't promise that maybe you won't have to take medicine to even you out, and I can't promise a lot of things, but here's what I can promise you. At the end of this story, God's going to take care of it. And when we are together with Him in heaven, there's not going to be the blues, because God's going to fix all that. But this hopelessness comes from the other side. Let's go back to another psalm. Psalm 6 reads like this. Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, or discipline me in your wrath. Have mercy on me, Lord, for I am faint. Heal me, Lord, for my bones are in agony. My soul is in deep anguish. How long, Lord, how long? Turn, Lord, and deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. Among the dead, no one proclaims your name. Who praises you from the grave? I am worn out from my groaning. All night long, I flood my bed with tears and drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow weak with sorrow, and they fail because of all my foes. But watch the move David makes. Verse 8. Away from me, all you who do evil, for the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy, and the Lord accepts my prayer. Okay, if you are wrestling, I want you to hear the Lord has heard your cry. The Lord has heard your tears, and the Lord has accepted your prayer. I think there is power in knowing that God has got something to do for and through you. So let me finish with what I think is, it's my very favorite Old Testament story. And it's my very favorite Old Testament story because I could so easily be the character in it. It comes from 1 Kings chapter 19. And I just want to read a little bit and then I'll tell the rest. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there, while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "I've had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the bush, and he fell asleep. Okay, I'm thinking Elijah's dealing with some depression. Okay, let me give some background. The chapter before this, Elijah has had one of the greatest victories in all of Scripture. He's gone up to Mount Carmel, and he's whooped a bunch of prophets of Baal and a bunch of priests of Asherah, and he has demonstrated to the world, or at least to Israel on that mountain, who really is in charge, and it's his God. And he comes down from that mountain triumphant, and my guess is he comes down from that mountain victorious with a smile on his face, and he runs and catches up with Ahab's chariot, and he says, "You better hurry because it's going to rain," and it hasn't rained in a long time. And then Jezebel comes. And there's a reason you don't name any of your children Jezebel. The only thing I've ever heard called Jezebel is a cat, and it was aptly deserved. So Jezebel comes on the story, and she says, "I'm going to do to you what you did to them," which is a death sentence. And Elijah goes instantly into this breakdown of his life. The rest of the story goes like this. He's under the bush asleep, and he's going to have this angel who will come in and say, "Get up and eat." And he'll have this dream three different times, and then for 40 days he's going to travel, and he's going to travel from where he was to this little cave, and he's going to get up in the cave, and he's going to have this other party with God that's based in pity, and he's going to start saying, "I'm the only one, I'm the only one, I'm the only one," and he's going to be frustrated and angry and sad and all of those things, and God is going to come eventually in the whisper. And he's going to say, "Elijah, let me tell you something. There's a new king on the horizon named Jehu. And there's a new prophet on the horizon named Elisha. And not only that, there are 7,000 people who have not bowed their knee to those false gods. Now let's go." In Elijah's very deepest, darkest, most depressing moment, God is going to say, "Let me tell you what's going to happen. First, you need a little rest." Okay, let me just again go with some of what the doctors have told me and therapists have told me. Your body, if it's a temple, you better take care of it. And one of the things you ought to be doing is trying to get a little sleep and to get a little good sleep. The next thing that happens is he gets some clarity. I love the phrase TLC, tender loving care. I think that's what that stands for. Maybe we ought to change it to tender loving clarity. To get a clearer picture of what's going on, to get a better understanding of the things that are going on in your life. And Elijah learned that he wasn't alone. He got some clarity. And then the third thing is he came across some very important people. Go find Elisha. Now what's interesting in Elijah's story is once he goes and finds Elisha, Elijah is never alone again, even when he wants to be. I mean, even when he's ready to go be with God and he says, "Elisha, why don't you stay here? I'm going to heaven." Elisha says, "Nuh-uh, I'm coming with you." And he tags right along. Okay. If you're down, whatever level that is, I think you need those same things. You need some rest and you need some relaxation. You need some techniques in your life to help you take those thoughts that run around your mind 1,000 miles an hour and figure out how to deal with them so you can go to sleep. And maybe that involves medicine, maybe that involves Bible study, maybe that involves therapy. I'm not discounting any of those things. But you need to find a way to rest and recharge. And then you need to get some clarity. You need to understand, why is this problem hitting me? Is it circumstantial? Is it spiritual? Is it chemical? And then find the best way in the midst of that to address those things. And then you need to surround yourself with people who can help you up. So when I have those moments where I'm blue, I usually pick up a phone and I call some, he's not a kid anymore now, he's got much gray hair as I do. I call some kid that lives in Indiana now and I say, "Hey, I just need to talk." And my friend talks. And sometimes he talks and I listen, and sometimes I talk and he listens, and sometimes we share and we wrestle, and sometimes we cry. And then we figure out a way to go the right way. You may need the same thing. the beauty of this church is you don't have to call Indiana to talk to one of your favorite preachers. You can find it right here in this room. Because there are men and women who've struggled like you've struggled. There are men and women in this room who have wrestled with their families. There are men and women who have wrestled with their jobs. There are men and women who have wrestled with addictions. There are men and women filling whatever blank you need to fill in, and they are there to remind you that you're not alone, to hold your hand, walk with you through the journey that you're on. Because being a Christian doesn't mean you're never going to struggle, and it doesn't mean you're never going to be down, and it may mean that even being a Christian, you might have long stints where depression is real in your life. But what I want you to hear is not only do we have a God that I believe who can help, we have got people around us that I believe can help. Because that's what community means. Okay, we go back to that statistic where the numbers have skyrocketed because of COVID or coming out of COVID. There was never a period in our lives where we were more alone than during COVID. I don't want to say there's a connection, but I want to say there's a connection. We lost community. We lost relationships. We lost interaction. We lost hugs. Even though I don't hug much, I still think relationships matter. We lost those things. I need not only to know that God is a God who can help me, but I need to know God's people are there to help me as well and to point me in the right directions. So if you got questions, come and talk to me. If you got questions, talk to the elders. If you got questions, talk to any number of our medical personnel that is here that interacts with this stuff on a day-to-day basis. And find the help that you need and trust that hopeless isn't the right answer. Okay, we're going to stand and sing the song Kent's chosen. I'll be here. Elders will be at each door. If you need us, come and find us. Kent, let's sing.